Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm the host for Funny Stuff, an hour of comedy, which is heard every week at this time here on KCRW. And this is a very special show. I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. Back in June, I was in New York City, and I recorded an interview with the English raconteur and author Quentin Crisp. And what a delightful, delightful man. He's 80 years old. He lives in a very small room in New York City, and it was one of the hottest nights anyone could remember in New York, which will explain the persistent hum. It's from a fan, not even from his apartment, but from the next apartment, but there was no way we could close the windows. The show also contains a lengthy excerpt from Quentin Crisp's one-man performance, An Evening with Quentin Crisp, so you'll hear the man at work. And what else is there to say? He's just delightful. It's just delightful. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy meeting him almost as much as I did. So without any further ado, here's my interview with Quentin Crisp. Every week I close this program by reminding you to always keep your sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. If ever there was a person who embodies this principle, it's my guest tonight, Mr. Quentin Crisp. Mr. Crisp has endured enough trials and tribulations for 10 men and still has not only maintained his sense of humor, but has sharpened it into an incisive tool with which he views the world from a unique and perceptive perspective. For those listeners unfamiliar with my guest, let me recommend a marvelous book, his autobiography called The Naked Civil Servant, and the film starring John Hurt, which was made from it. The film renewed interest in the book and in Mr. Crisp, who has since toured the world in lecture tours, speaking and writing on the subject of living with style and good manners. Tell us a little bit about the world you grew up in and how you fit into it.
Well, I was unable to fit into the world in which I grew up, because I was born to middling, middle-class, middle-brow parents in the suburbs outside London. And this conditioned my life. I was unfit to join the human race, totally. And I tried at first, like most young people, I alternately rebelled and conformed. But after the age of about 25, I no longer made any effort to disguise myself as a human being. I gave all that up and lived my life on my own terms, at a great price, but nevertheless, I did live it.
Well, what did you think you were, if not a human being?
I don't know. I never managed to fit in. This is long before I did anything peculiar, like wear pointed fingernails or long hair or any of that rubbish. When I was a schoolboy and couldn't do anything weird to my appearance, I still didn't manage to fit in. I never managed to be able to be a schoolboy.
Now, someone today growing up just like you were then would be able to fit in, probably.
Well, it's
because it's a different world now.
It's a very different world. Of course, I live in big cities, and I always have, and this conditions my view on the world. If I lived now in a small village in America, I would doubtless find my life much more difficult than I do living in Manhattan. But nevertheless, it is much easier. You are quite right in the matter, for instance, of appearance, which is superficial. Nevertheless, it does condition part of your life. There is nothing you could wear on Second Avenue in this district where I live that would make you remarkable, so that you already feel much freer to do as you please.
Mm-hmm. Now, what led you to write an autobiography?
I was told to write it. I've never written any book by sitting in my room thinking, I will write this book. I've always waited until I was told to write a book, and then I wrote it. And I said a few words, which were broadcast on the third program, I think it was called, in England, a highbrow program. And this caused a publisher to say that I should write a book. And in the end, he didn't publish it. He was frightened. But somebody else was found who did. So I received the money before I began, or some of it. And so I wrote it.
Has anyone approached you about continuing that story from where that first book leaves off in 1968 or so?
Well, that ended, yes, I suppose, in about 1966, by which time I would have been about 57, and it was published, as you say, very early in 1968. Since then, I have written How to Become a Virgin, which explains my life since then and explains the writing of that book and the effect it had on my life.
I see. And does it sum up your life so far since then?
And it summed up my life up to about 1980.
I see.
And the words, How to Become a Virgin, apply to the fact that once you've been on television in America, you become a virgin. All your sins are taken away. Every terrible thing you've done in your past is forgotten. You become a sort of pseudo-saint.
When did you first realize that you had, as Noel Coward puts it, a talent to amuse?
Bit by bit, very slowly, because, of course, when I was a child, any effort to show off was repressed at once by my parents and by the ridicule of my sister and my brothers. I mean, you couldn't wave your arms in the air without being told you were showing off. And so I tried to behave nicely in those days. But as I gave it up, I acquired, of course, in the end, friends. I lived in England in the same room for 41 years. So if you have the same address and the same phone number for all that length of time, you in the end acquire friends. And the way to keep them is either to spend money on them or to entertain them. You have to do the one or the other or they will leave. And so, as I had no money, I had to find a way of entertaining them.
Did you always secretly think, even at the very worst times, that deep down you were someone that people would, or at least should, pay to hear expound on his ideas?
Oh, no, never. I was put into the smiling and nodding racket by my agent in England. He had taken a theatre which was no more than a room behind a public house in Islington in the north of London. And in those days there were what were called opening hours. I don't know whether Americans know this. The bars opened at 11:30 or 12:30, shut at 2:30 or 3:30, opened again in the evening. Well, he knew what he was doing in the evening. He was putting on a play called Madame de Sade, which was being directed by a friend of his. But he didn't want to waste the lunchtime hours. So he said, I thought you could go on then. And I said, with what object, my good man? And he said, you could talk to people. And when I said, about what, he said, it doesn't matter. You needn't even say the same thing each day. So I went on to the stage. We were frequently down to three people in the audience. I used to get off the stage and sit at one of the tables.
Your book hadn't come out yet at
the time. Before the book came out. The book had come out. When the television playing came out, then everything was different. Then I went to the Edinburgh Festival, where you can do no wrong. Everybody is there to be entertained. That's why they're all there.
You don't give yourself much credit for perhaps actually having a worthwhile presentation.
No, I think it would be a mistake to think that I had any talent. All I have got is that I'm infinitely available.
Well, so is almost anyone.
No, they guard themselves. There are questions...
You could call my dentist and say, come and speak, and if the price was right, he would be available.
He would be available. Then he must be willing to be totally given over to the audience. Whatever they say, he must deal with it. And he must answer, but he must never answer back.
Well, there's certainly a lot more to what you have to say than just being willing to not answer back. And I think you sell yourself short.
Well, I'll revise my basic theory from now onward.
I suppose I deserve that. No, but there's real wisdom in much of what you have to say. Which I believe to be uncommon. Which is why people will pay their hard-earned money to come and see you and buy your books.
Possibly.
And if not wisdom, at least insight. You might be more comfortable with that.
Well, from the age of 16 onward, and I never thought about it when I was young, I spent a lot of my time with women at least 10 years older than myself telling me about their broken hearts. I never thought, why am I in this situation? But I spent a lot of time with women. They, as you know, a theatre goer throughout the world is a middle-aged woman with a broken heart. Men never go gladly to the theatre. All the men in the theatre are there because their wives have said, of course you're coming, who will drive the car? That's why they're there. But the women are there and they want to be told fundamentally how to be happy.
I've been forbidden to describe this occasion as a straight talk from a bent speaker. So instead, we'll say it's like a consultation with a doctor who is more ill than you are. I really am here to try to cure you of your freedom, because I'm convinced that it's an excess of freedom which has made everybody in the world so miserable. In Britain, I have no difficulty in persuading people that they're unhappy. The trouble comes when I tell them that they're free. Nobody seems to make any comparison between himself and somebody in the same circumstances in a time gone by. This amazes me. I come from a time when there was so little liberty that if a girl wanted to wear nail varnish, she had to leave home for good. And if a man wore suede shoes, then there was nothing for him to do but join the Foreign Legion. I know it's too late to ask you to abide by laws handed down to you by your pastors and your masters and your elders and your betters. So what we need is chains of our own making. However heavy these may be, they will never feel as irksome as limitations placed on us by others. Not any old chains. We have to have a system, and that begins with each of us trying to decide what it is that makes him the way he is. It involves a journey to the interior, not altogether a pleasant experience. Because as well as totting up what you consider to be your assets, you also have to take a long look at what your friends call the trouble with you. And the synthesis between these two opposite opinions will be your identity. But that's not quite enough. It's like your fingerprints. These two are your very own, but if they are discovered, they may be used against you. Therefore, you have to polish up your raw identity until it becomes a lifestyle, something interesting by which you are prepared, by which you are proud to be identified, and something with which you can do barter with the outer world to get from it what you want. I won't say what you deserve, because if we all got what we deserved, we would starve. And this polishing up process will make your days so formal that compared with them, the life of a Trappist monk would seem like an orgy. Now, I know I'm rattling on about problems which by world standards would be trivial. This I understand. But I do so because never a day goes by, well, never a month goes by, without someone coming to me and saying, "Oh, you do have a nice life." Me. This would be a reasonable remark if I lived as you do, in mansions riddled with standard of living. But I don't. I live in one room which has never been cleaned in 35 years. And that brings me to my first message of hope. Never sweep the place where you live, because after the first 4 years, the dirt doesn't get any worse. It's just a question of not losing your nerve. I'm sure I'm right about this. The other day a woman said to me, "No wonder you're nice to everybody. You never do any housework." So now it transpires that all the women in the world are in a blind rage by 10:30 in the morning. Worn out, I shouldn't wonder, with all that sweeping, dusting, washing up. Now, there's no need to wash up unless you find that you've passed the fish barrier. It works like this. When you're hungry and you look at your plate and it says bacon, you think, "I could eat an egg." And the next day, when your plate says egg, you think, "I could eat a fish." But when you've eaten the fish, you have to wash up. I'm only telling you these things so as to set you free from these boring domestic rituals, so as to give you some time during each day when you stop looking outward and start looking inward, so as to decide who you truly are. You understand that? You can convert your style into riches and enjoy them, or you can enjoy your style just the way it is. There's no other connection between the two. And of this also, I can give you an example. Until recently, there was in Soho, the hooligan district of London, a woman known as the Countess. But in spite of this, she had in fact no fixed address and no means of support, and her body was perpetually bent double from a lifelong habit of looking in the dustbins to see if she could possibly find there something she could sell to a kind friend, or if not, that she herself could use. And one day, in a trash can in the most expensive part of London, she found a complete backless bead dress. She longed for night to fall so that she could nip into a dark doorway and try it on. But by about 6:30, her patience had worn out. It was barely dusk, but she went into a churchyard in the middle of London, and there she proceeded to take off her clothes. This caused a crowd to collect. And the crowd caused a policeman to collect. And the next day, in court, when the magistrate said, "And what exactly were you doing, stripping among the dead?" she replied, "I was doing what any woman would be doing at that hour, changing for dinner." So So you see, however grandiose the style you may have chosen for yourself, you will not need any actual money to support it. But of course, before you can build some such dizzy, dazzling structure as a monument to yourself, you must first get the foundations of your private life absolutely solid. From now onward, I think you should try to regard your home as your dressing room, and the world will be your stage. And at home, there must be nothing which doesn't represent the kind of person you have decided to become. It doesn't matter if your house is full of gadgets which are advertised on television every 20 minutes. They've got to go. And when you've got rid of the superfluous things, you start on the unnecessary actions. From now onward, there should be no doodling and no dawdling, and I used to say there must be no daydreaming. But now I've changed my opinion, and I think you're allowed your daydreams up to the age of 25. But after that, they may become an alibi. Do you understand me? It's no good running a pig farm badly for 30 years while saying, really, I was meant to be a ballet dancer. By that time, pigs will be your style. But, of course, it's not enough merely to get the foundations of your home life squared up. You also have to decide what you're going to do in the outer world. Now, some of you may be so old-fashioned that you still have jobs. If this is so, try not to get stuck in work where you only deal with things. And I include the highest possible level of things. Sculpture, books, paintings. They are only objects, just like washing machines, but not so useful. It would be difficult for me to translate the dilemma that lies before the visual artist into American terms, because I've only been here a little while. But in England, if I could show you a huge great piece of concrete with a hole in it, everybody would say, it's a Henry Moore. But if I could show you Henry Moore himself, nobody would know who he was. So all that chipping, all that chiseling, it's been in vain. You must have a job where you deal with people, because then every waking working hour you will be secretly polishing up your techniques of self-projection. There are plenty of such jobs available. There's preaching. All the great evangelists of the world have been American, so this shouldn't be difficult for you. Before any of you were born, I saw Amy Semple Macpherson, magnificent, dressed in white from head to foot, with red, nay, scarlet hair. And she said, the Lord has sent out his angels on speed bikes of mercy. You could try something like that. Well, if you don't want to be a preacher, you could be a teacher. Teaching is also very stylish, because the material in which you're working is nearly always children and teenagers, and they have built-in publicity value. It doesn't matter whether you encourage them or repress them, you're in. And the great teaching stylist was a man called Mr. Braithwaite. He wrote a book called To Sir With Love. It caused a great sensation when it was first published. But in that book, there is not one sentence about education, about whether history is easier to teach than geography. It is full of what the children, their parents, and the other members of the staff thought about the writer. So now we know that whatever anyone says they're teaching, their subject is always themselves. Teaching is for teachers, not for students. And if you'd known that when you were at school, all your sufferings would have been at least explicable. But if you can't be a teacher, if there's nothing that you know and they don't, then you can try politics. And the great political stylist was Mrs. Perron. Not the one you've got now, the one before that. I don't know if any of you realize in what a personal and at the same time pervasive way she ruled her kingdom. In England, spelling primers begin with the words "the cat sat on the mat." No wonder literacy is at a low ebb. When the first glimpse of it is this banal and even distasteful piece of information. But in Argentina, spelling books began, "I love Evita." And the crowning moment of her entire career was when she stood up in her box in the opera house in Buenos Aires to make a speech. She lifted her hands to the crowd, and as she did so, with a sound like railway trucks in a siding, the diamond bracelet slid from her wrist. When the expensive clatter had died away, her speech began, "We the shirtless." Now, I see that you don't really believe in Mrs. Perón, but the Argentinians did, so much so that when she died, they petitioned the Pope to make her a saint. His Holiness declined. But if he'd consented, what a triumph for style that would have been. A double fox stole, ankle strap shoes, and eternal life. Nobody's ever had that. But if you feel that all this preaching and teaching, that they're insufficient to embody your idea of yourself, the career which will give you the most direct route to self-fulfillment is the stage. And you must also remember, when you think about the stage, that the journey made by an actress from anonymity to stardom is the path that all of you must tread in one context or another. In the beginning of her career, an actress plays a great number of very different parts. Anything she can get, actually. And at that stage, she says that what she enjoys is the variety. Later on, it's noticeable that she plays fewer, more closely related parts. Now, this is like attacking your identity Red Indian fashion. The circles of experimentation get smaller and smaller until you arrive at the center. In the second half of her career, an actress says that what she likes is the opportunity to study character in depth. She means her own. Because finally, with luck, she finds the one part which fits in every detail, her dream of herself. After many long, dark years, Betty Davis was finally given the part of Regina in The Little Foxes, and this gave her the chance to say, "Very well then, die." And we could see from the glaring eyes and the mouth worn upside down, that's what she'd been waiting to say since 1936. Now, once an actress has found her ideal part, from that moment onward, she never looks forward. She's given up the profession of acting, and she has entered the profession of being. And this, as I see it, is where all of you, in the end, belong. Are you still with me? Do you understand this, are you? Good. Because there is a very special glow which surrounds people who've succeeded in synthesizing their professional and their personal lives. Joan Crawford appeared in any number of movies in which she rose from rags to riches. And in real life, she finally married Mr. Pepsi Cola. And she had all the luck in the world because he died. This meant that she herself could enter the boardroom of that vast worldwide empire, where presumably she said, "Who told you to read the minutes?" just as she'd done in all her movies. When I turn on my television set, what does it show me? Someone stomping through the streets, screeching for equal pay, equal opportunity. Equal is a dead word. Never take as your object in life the desire to be anybody's equal. Once you have entered the profession of being, you have become a professor of a subject on which you are the only living authority. What other people do with their life, with their style, will not matter. In fact, every morning, you should say to yourselves, preferably aloud, "Other people are a mistake." No, I withdraw that remark. It might be thought sweeping. Say to yourself, "Concern with other people is a mistake." Now, I know this is not what most people teach you, but I am trying to spare you the traditional scramble for mutual self-sacrifice. Altruism is a debilitating, fragmenting process. But the constant watchover and the perfection of your idea of yourself and the presentation of it, gift-wrapped, to others, that is a unifying and invigorating way of life. And it carries with it a built-in invitation to the party at the end of the world. That glittering function at which everybody will be speaking and nobody will be listening. And if you're armed with your style, you will be able to run toward that happy hubbub without the faintest fear that you may be out of your depth. Without the faintest doubt but that you will shine. And more important than any of this, the burdens of your sorrowful and angry freedom. These problems of who to be and where to go and even what to think, they will fall away from you forever.
You're listening to A Visit with Quentin Crisp on Funny Stuff here on KCRW Santa Monica, 89.9 FM. We're a community service of Santa Monica College. My name is Bob Claster, and now back to the interview with Quentin Crisp. You've said that you thrive on alienation.
In a way, yes. I'm by nature an alien because of my difference from other people and the hostility in which I grew up. And I am now accustomed to it and prefer, for instance, to live alone. I couldn't now live with anybody. I've asked people who share their lives with others how they manage to be wise, witty, kind, and beautiful for 24 hours a day, and they never answer. They laugh nervously, but they never tell you. And obviously that is what is needed, and I cannot do it. I would in the end be my horrible self, and then my relationship with whoever it was would come to an end. So I live alone, but I like the world. In America, of course, everybody is your friend, which makes an enormous difference. See, in England, nobody is your friend. You have to make friends in England. It's very tiring. And when you've made them in England, you get stuck with them, which is more tiring. But in America, you never get stuck with anybody. 3 weeks is a meaningful relationship.
Well, there must be a lot of people for whom you are a friend because of some of the groundbreaking that you have done, which has made their lives a bit easier.
Well, if this is so, I'm very glad. What one mustn't do is claim to have lived one's life for the sake of other people. I've lived my life in the only way I knew how. If other people have benefited by this, then I'm very pleased that they have.
You have any regrets?
Not really, because before you can use the word regret, you have to be able to look back and realize that you made a poor choice of some kind. If you can look back and say, oh, I should have stayed in this job longer, or I should never have done that job, or I should never have gotten to know that crowd of people. I never had any alternatives in my life. I've done the work from which I was not given the sack. I've lived in the rooms from which I was not evicted. And I've known the people who could put up with the disgrace. So I don't look back and think I did wrong at any moment. I've done various things that were wrong. But I don't feel I should have chosen differently because I'm a victim of fate.
Well, in a sense, we're all victims of fate, but it seems as if you've made a choice to live your life in as passive a manner as possible.
I have indeed. My agent says that I have raised passivity to the level of an art form. And in a way I have. It is my way of dealing with everything. And it's the result, of course, in part, of acquiring an agent. Once you have an agent, you don't have to do anything. When people speak to you, even when people rush up to me in the street and say, hello, how are you? I say, I've no idea. You'll have to ask my agent.
I wonder if any of them do. Getting back to this passivity, that's a choice that you continually make.
Yes.
So as a result, you go to parties you're invited to.
I go to parties I'm invited to. I meet the people who want to meet me. I speak to the people who want to speak to me. It's the ideal way of living because now I'm never to blame.
You've advised this sort of passivity as a good method of getting through life.
I guess you have to do it, but you have to stop short of actually throwing your life away. You can rely on the kindness of strangers like Blanche Dubois, but you have to do it with a certain amount of caution or you will come unstuck altogether.
And does this passivity come naturally to you, or does it require effort?
It comes naturally, but I worked at it as well. I think it's part of my nature, but when I was a child, I was violent-tempered, but I was the youngest child, and I knew I would never win. So I had to learn to feign not to be upset or angry at the ridicule heaped upon me by my parents or my sister or my brothers.
Do you feel a sense of victory, having survived it all?
Well, in a sense, yes.
You've probably outlived most of your tormentors.
I've outlived my tormentors. I never required a revenge upon them. I only required to find a way of getting through my life, which I never expected to do so easily as I do now. I mean, financially, of course, I'm on the verge of extinction, but socially, I don't have any trouble in living.
Is there anything you've always wanted to do?
Well, someone asked me that some time ago, and I racked my brains, and I was able to say that I would like to be in a Technicolor widescreen first feature movie. Well, now I've been in one, and I am cured of a desire to be a movie star. It was the most uncomfortable occupation of my entire life. I was sprayed with steam, threatened with flames, deluged with sand, and had glass thrown in my face.
What was this film?
This film was called The Bride, and it featured Mr. Sting, a charming man, very, very courteous, very nice.
Is there anyone you've always wanted to meet?
Not really. I feel ashamed of that. I ought to want to meet. I like everybody, so that I think that means that my desire to meet a person has been spread over the whole world. But, no, I can't say I've ever thought when someone's name is mentioned or when their photograph appears, I don't think I've ever thought, oh, if only I could meet them. Because this idea of the joy of meeting stars doesn't really have any reality. If you could meet Marlene Dietrich herself, you couldn't say, it's a great honor, Miss Dietrich, to meet you. I haven't seen all your movies. And she could say, thank you. And that would be the end of that. You happen to have the house next door before the day comes when you can say, how did you come to be Marlene Dietrich?
Mm-hmm. Well, then, is there anyone... Let's say you had to be stranded on a desert island, and you had to have company. Who would you choose for your companion?
No one I can think of, but I would need someone very resourceful, because I couldn't do anything. I would die in the first week.
Well, to make it a more realistic question, let's say you had to take a transatlantic voyage on an ocean liner and had to share a stateroom with someone. Maybe that's a bit more...
I don't think I would really mind. There again, there's almost nobody of whom I think, I hope I never get stuck with them. So that almost anyone would do. I prefer the society of women. So if I had to have a companion, it would be a woman, because women are cozier, quieter, friendlier, and they like to talk. So that's why I prefer the society of women. But I don't know that it would matter.
Do you ever think how your life would have been different if you had been born at a time more tolerant of homosexuality?
I think my personality would have been different. I would have been less shrill than I am. I would have been nicer, cozier, better behaved, and all those things, because my life would not have been one long protest. But otherwise, I don't know that it would have been all that different. I've got by. I've done the work people found for me. Never well, but I've done it. And after all, I've arrived in America. I mean, very late in the day, but I have got here.
Have you gone ahead with your plans to become an American citizen?
Well, I haven't gone any further. I am now only a twilight American, because I've reached an age when I couldn't learn all you happen to know, or to be more accurate, I couldn't remember it. You could teach me before dawn everything I would need to know at the interview, but by Monday I would have forgotten it. As you grow older, you can't remember immediately. You remember the names of people you were in school with, but you can't remember how it happened yesterday.
Right.
So that I think now I'll have to stay in the twilight.
You lived your formative years with the knowledge that you were likely to be harassed or arrested at any time. Do you ever lose that expectation, that sense that around the corner there's always lurking something?
You never lose it in England. Here you are, perhaps falsely, lulled into a feeling that it will be all right, because people are so cozy here. I mean, even the police are cozy in New York. They drive their cars at walking pace beside you, and if you're foolish enough to look toward them, they beckon you. And when you go over, they ask your name, and I tell them my name, and I say, am I illegal? And they say, no, we just wondered how the show was going. Well, an English policeman is never going to ask you how the show is going.
That's wonderful. You once lived in Southern California for a while, which is where this program is heard. Now, what did you think of it?
I lived in Los Angeles for 3 months to work at Mr. Solari's theater, which I think has been pulled down or turned into a car park or something. And I was there for 3 months, and I loved working there, because as you look down into the audience, everybody is a movie star. I mean, that's quite extraordinary, to be walking up and down saying what you think in front of a lot of movie actors is quite amazing, and they're very generous. They do applaud. They do appear to want you to succeed. I loved Los Angeles altogether. It's really only New York lying down, which everybody is beautiful and everybody is rich. All the women are actresses and all the men are lawyers.
If, as is sometimes claimed, when one dies, one's whole life goes flashing before one's eyes like a Technicolor movie, which scenes are you most looking forward to seeing again?
Oh, I don't know about that. My life has been much more pleasant in the last... I've lived in America now for 8 years. My life has been much more pleasant recently. When I look back over my life, mostly I feel embarrassed. And so we can say the bits that we hope won't flash before my eyes as I die will be those bits which I expect are in everybody's life. When you make a fool of yourself, you stay in somebody's house much too long. When you get home, you think, they were waiting for me to go and I didn't realize it. Or you ring up people much too often, or whatever. Those are the bits that when I look back, I either think, oh, I shouldn't have done this or that, or else I think, I could have done more. When someone's name is mentioned, I'm sure this happens to a lot of people, you think, oh, yes, I could have been nicer. I could have let him stay longer. I could have lent him another dollar. I could have written him another reference for a job I know he can't do. I could have laughed at his jokes and not said, I've heard this before. There's always more you should have done for people. So there are things I hope I won't have to think about, rather than things I'm longing to see again.
But not one scene that you'd look forward to reliving?
I know.
Moment of triumph.
I suppose I'm triumphed in that that I have, as you would say, gone on the stage. I went to the Amundsen in Los Angeles, which is the size of a cathedral. And they wired me up for sound, and I spoke to that great sea of faces. And until the invention of Jackie Mason, as far as I know, I'm the only person in the world who ever went on the stage and neither sang nor danced nor acted, but just said what he thought. So in a way, you could say that was a minor triumph.
Do you have any plans to do that again?
I think I've said it all now.
But there are many that didn't see you the first time.
Well, yes, I could go into new places, but I've been to a hell of a lot of places. I've been as far west as you would say, as Los Angeles, San Diego, Santa Barbara. And I've been as far north as Minnesota and Detroit, and as far south as New Orleans. Further south, I've been to Key West, the furthest south that you can go.
Given the opportunity, would you fly on the space shuttle?
Not really. I go to places to be seen rather than to see. So I'm not really what you would call a traveler.
Have you ever been psychoanalyzed?
I don't believe in psychoanalysis. I think it is another alibi. The world is full of alibis, like astrology. Astrology is an alibi. If you can say, I know I behaved badly, but I was born in May, this is an alibi. If you can say, I know I behaved badly, but my nanny shut me in a cupboard when I was two, this is an alibi. The answer is not how terrible for you, but you're not two any longer. Pull yourself together. And so that, no, I don't believe in psychoanalysis. I don't think we have an unconscious. I think we know exactly what we're doing, and we are to blame.
You are now entering your ninth decade.
Yes.
Do you think much about death?
I think about death, and I try to think about it a lot so as to get used to the idea. I hope to die fairly soon, because I've got to die before my clothes wear out, or else I would have to buy some more, which would be worrying. So I trust that I'll die in the next year or two, but I wouldn't mind dying tomorrow or now. I don't want to die a violent death, and I don't want, of course, to die a painful death. I would like to know a few hours or days before I die that I'm going to die, so as to compose myself. But I have made a will, though I have almost nothing to leave. And I've tidied up my life to a large extent. I think everybody should live their life in such a way that they don't think they will lie on an iron bedstead in a rented room with people standing round them saying he can't last much longer. And the person in the bed thinks, I always wanted a house in the Hamptons, and now I think I'll die and not have had it. I think you happen to live your life as though you might only ever have one thing you really want, and you should decide now what that is, and you should move, if you possibly can, toward it. Of course, I know the world is full of people who spend all their energy just staying alive. I mean, the world is full of them. But if you have any choice at all, I think you have not to think, I'll think about that later. I think you have to think about it now. What would I really regret not having done?
And what would you really regret not having done?
I would have regretted never having got to America.
What do you think will happen when you die? Do you believe in an afterlife?
I don't believe in an afterlife. I can't afford to. Like most people, I believe not that of which I could be convinced by logic. I believe what my temperament inclines me to believe. And the one thing I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy is eternal life. It's nice that it will end. And that is why I don't believe in reincarnation or a life after death. I've read Miss MacLean's book, and it's wonderful, and it's fascinating. But she never expresses any weariness.
Mm-hmm.
If she remembers that she's lived all these other lives, isn't she hoping that one day it will be over? And she will rest. You know how Uncle Vanya ends, when the girl says, "When we are dead, we shall smile at our sufferings. God will be kind to us, and we shall rest."
What would you like on your tombstone?
I don't really mind. People have asked me that. What would you like have written on your tombstone? How do you wish to be remembered? It won't matter. I shall be dead. The people who ask those questions think they will look down from a cloud and count the people at their funeral. I've got news for them. They'll be dead.
What's the best thing that could happen to you tomorrow?
I suppose death would be the answer.
I don't know how to follow that. I think we're finished. I thank you for putting up with this on this hottest of hot New York nights.
It's been a pleasure.
Well, I hope so. It's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you, Quentin Crisp. And that's going to wrap up this hour, this visit with Quentin Crisp. If you're interested in more stuff on Quentin Crisp, he's written a number of books. The Naked Civil Servant is the autobiography covering the first two-thirds of his life. And then there's How to Be a Virgin, which is out of print, unfortunately, but you may be able to find it in the library. Doing It with Style is a very delightful book of his. And there's also the film based on The Naked Civil Servant starring John Hurt, which is rentable. And also An Evening with Quentin Crisp you can find in better videos. Stores of his, you know, one-man lecture and question and answers. It's absolutely delightful. If you'd like to get a message to Quentin, you can drop a letter to him care of me here, and I will see to it that he gets it. The address is Bob Claster, Funny Stuff, KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. Make sure it has my name rather than his name on the outside, because otherwise he won't get it. Next week we'll be listening to Fire Sign Theater, and we'll have Peter Bergman here to talk about it. We'll be listening to Don't Crush That Dwarf, Hand Me the Pliers. And that's about it. So until next week, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.